Hello and welcome to this, the 100th edition of YCT Matters. For the 100th time, this is Carol Platt Liebau, president of Yankee Institute. And to commemorate this epoch, we are actually able to welcome one of the most special guests we've ever had. And that is someone who, this will embarrass him to hear, but it's true, has been a hero of our First Amendment free speech rights. And this year's Yankee Institute Champions of Freedom Gala speaker, Seth Dillon, the CEO of the Babylon Bee, an entrepreneur and venture investor, and honestly, the person who actually prompted Elon Musk to take over Twitter and keep all of our free speech rights safe for at least a while here in the United States. It is a greater honor than I can say to welcome Seth Dillon to the 100th edition of YCT Matters. Seth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. And I appreciate the kind words. To be joining you on the 100th episode, that's pretty awesome too. Congratulations on 100.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for everything you do. So, you know, since we are, our time here is not unlimited, let's jump right into it. I would love to know how you came up with the idea of creating the Babylon Bee, which, as we all know, and as you say, is the world's most trusted, factually accurate accurate news source.
Well, the idea for the site was kind of born out of this, the fact that there was just very little being done to push back on the secular progressive left. And their effort to they basically had taken over comedy and entertainment, right? So most of the comedians and the late night shows and all of that were, and even satire sites like The Onion were all dominated by a particular set of values and worldview. And there wasn't really much that was being done to counter that. And so the Bee was started as an answer to that, we were described initially as a conservative version of The Onion or a Christian version of The Onion. And those are there. We don't like thinking of ourselves in those terms necessarily, because we are our own site and we just try to do news satire. But it is an apt description in the sense that we were created as an answer to what was going on the other side and just offering a different perspective. And so, you know, we have a Christian staff and we're conservative and we're looking at the issues from our own worldview and we're trying to do satire that makes fun of the things that deserve to be made fun of. And for the reason that if you don't ridicule bad ideas, you might end up taking them seriously. And that's not great.
No, it's not. And heaven knows we are living in a target-rich environment these days.
Yes.
And so, you know, I'm always interested in how your creative process works. Do you all have a virtual writer's room, or do you have various writers who are sort of assigned, some to politics, some to call? I mean, how does the whole Bee sort of work?
Well, we have writers. They're not all in the same location. It is largely virtual. We have a couple of different offices, one in South Florida and one in Southern California. And so our writers will coordinate with each other, pitching headlines. You know, the joke is in the headline. You got to nail it in the headline. And so we pitch headlines back and forth all day long. And we do that on the back of whatever's just going on in the world. So we look at the headlines that are out there. In reality, oftentimes they feel like satire or parody themselves. Like you said, it's a target-rich environment. And it does make the job difficult, because we have to exaggerate. The way that satire works oftentimes is by when you're engaging in parody, you're exaggerating what's already there. You're doing a caricature of it, right? So when the world is crazy, it becomes difficult to satirize it, because it's hard to caricature a caricature. Then it just gets too insane. So that's what we do. We look at the headlines, then we pitch ideas back and forth, and when we land on some good ones, we publish them.
It's fantastic. And, you know, what has been amazing is that there is now this cottage industry, along with The Simpsons, in people cataloging all the times. And I think you call it your book of prophecy. Yeah. All the satirical headlines you came up with that ended up being akin to fulfilled prophecies. File it under the "you can't make this stuff up" file.
Yeah, we do. We track them now. The Simpsons has had a lot of jokes that they're famous for many reasons, but also for having told jokes 8, 9, 10, 15 years ago that end up, you know, in some sense coming true. And that's just kind of the direction that is as reality bends closer and closer towards the satirical and in the fantastical, you know, which is how outrageous things are becoming, and the more extreme views are becoming more predominant in mainstream. You're going to have that kind of naturally happen, because in the past, you know, when you've made jokes that kind of exaggerate the truth to make a point, well, if you're going down a road where truth itself is being exaggerated, then eventually you'll have those places where satire and reality meet, and the jokes come true. And so we've had that happen over 100 times now. At this point, we're tracking them in a spreadsheet. We've got, like, I think it's like 104 or 105 times we've told a joke that to some degree, either almost to the actual letter, came true. Like, for example, we did a joke about how Gavin Newsom had been named U-Haul Salesperson of the Year because so many people were leaving and fleeing California to go to Texas. And that was what the article was about, specifically, you know, U-Haul in Texas. And then, like, a month later, there's a Fox Business article about how, you know, U-Haul has run out of trucks because so many people are fleeing California for Texas. And so it was the same company that was referenced, the same states that were referenced, you know, so it was like, it was very closely aligned with the joke. And there's, you know, there's lots of silly ones. We've told jokes about how, you know, the only people still wearing masks at this point are just super unattractive. And then there was a study that found that attractive people are much less likely to wear masks than unattractive people. And so it's like, you know, they're jokes, but, you know, there's truth to them. And there is a saying, right? There's a grain of truth in every joke. So maybe that's why.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So when, you know, all this censorship came around, what is remarkable to me is this push to censor humor. And I suppose it's because in some ways humor conveys a deeper truth that sort of sticks with people in a highly memorable fashion. But for some of our listeners that may not be as familiar with what happened, would you mind recapping quickly what did happen when Twitter, under the sort of ancien regime, reached out to you because of what you were doing and essentially tried to silence you?
Yeah, well, it's manifested itself a few different ways when it comes to humor and the types of censorship that we faced. It initially started with fact checking. So we had jokes that were getting fact checked by Snopes and other third party fact checkers, rating our jokes false. And then the social media platforms were telling us, look, if you keep publishing false information, we're going to deplatform you. And you were like, where's the room for satire? Why can't we tell jokes? Like, jokes don't really have a truth rating. They're either funny or not, but they're not true or false, really. Although there can be truth to them. Like you said, I think humor is a very effective vehicle for truth delivery. And that is part of the reason that it's deemed a threat. You know, tyrants especially hate to be mocked and laughed at. They want to be able to control what you think about them and what you're able to say. And so, you know, mockery, because it's so effective, it's far more effective in making them seem foolish or evil than a standard argument.
And which is so, why they hate it so much.
It's why they hate it so much. Yes. It's very, makes them bristle. And so we found that this, you hear wokeness blamed for a lot of things, but, there was a specific example, our case with Twitter that you're referencing, you know, where we got suspended on Twitter for a joke that we had made. This was a situation where wokeness had been applied to comedy. So you have this standard now for comedy that Facebook has adopted and Twitter pre-Elon had adopted, where you can make jokes, but you're not allowed to punch down. And punching down means that, you know, if you're in a position of power and privilege, you're up here, and you're making fun of a group.
Power and privileged as they define it.
As they define it, yes. Right. As they define it. In their hierarchy, if you're powerful and privileged, and you make fun of somebody or a group of people who are lacking power and privilege, then what you're doing is you're punching down on them. It's abusive. It's bullying. It's harassment. It's hateful. And it should not be permitted. And it's interesting because what they're doing is that's the reason I say that's wokeness is because it's that, you know, it's that sociocultural Marxism view of the world that pits everyone against each other as oppressor. You're either oppressed, oppressive, or you're the oppressed.
Right.
And so they applied that standard to comedy. And they tried to suggest that, you know, we can't make jokes about people who are beneath us on this standard. And it's a weird thing. Like I've talked about this a lot, about how condescending it is to have this idea in your head as you're writing a joke. Like, you know what? I shouldn't make fun of those people. They're beneath me. I mean, that's right. Just so,
that is so patronizing.
It's so condescending. And it's just reinforcing this idea that there is actually inequality between people. Like, I, for one, would be extremely offended, more offended than I would be by any joke a comedian told
right.
me. If someone told me, you know what, you're too fragile to handle comedy. You shouldn't be, no one should joke at your expense. Like I would feel very, very offended by that. I would say, no, bring it on. I can handle a joke.
Right.
Why treat me as being so fragile? You know, why try to protect me in that way? I think the way that we treat each other equally is to joke about each other indiscriminately. And so I do reject this whole idea that we're punching down for a number of reasons, that being one of them. And I'm getting to your main question in just a second, but
it's okay. I'm enjoying the ride. Go right ahead.
I reject the idea of punching down for all of many reasons. I reject the woke hierarchy that they tried to stick us in. And I also don't agree. An important point that you made was by their standard, you know, the powerful and privileged should not be making fun of, you know, people who are in groups that lack power and privilege. Well, who's to say that I'm really the powerful and privileged one? I mean, I can't get somebody suspended for making a joke at my expense. I don't have all the most powerful institutions in the world at my back, ready to go to war, defending me from even having my feelings hurt. I mean, I think that the people who are described as marginalized and oppressed are people like Dylan Mulvaney, who's on the red carpet everywhere with cameras right. flashing and huge sponsorship deals with major brands and every major powerful institution at his back. If you have all of that in your corner and you can silence anyone who so much as makes a joke at your expense, then you're actually extremely powerful. You are not marginalized. In fact, you're the oppressive one. You're the tyrant. Right. If you're able and willing to shut people up who are making jokes about you, you're the tyrant.
And so, they always say, if you want to know who is truly powerful in a society, find out whom you're not allowed to make fun of.
There you go. Yeah, that's who rules over you, right? Mm-hmm. Is the people that you can't make fun of, you can't criticize. And so it is actually the inverse of what they say. The people that supposedly lack power and privilege, they're being protected by this whole system is actually a demonstration and proof of their power and privilege. They're the ones who are up here. And so when we are making jokes at the expense of, you know, radical trans ideology or, you know, whatever the thing is, wokeness, we are punching up, not down.
Agreed.
And so... So I reject that whole schema for a number of reasons. What happened, short version, what happened was we published a joke in response to a USA Today headline. They had named Rachel Levine, this transgender health admiral, their pick for, you know, woman of the year. And then we made fun of that by naming Rachel Levine our pick for man of the year. And that was considered hateful conduct. It was misgendering. And so we got locked out of our Twitter account. They wanted us to delete that tweet in order to get our account back. So it was deemed hateful conduct because we were punching down on a marginalized, oppressed, white, male, high-ranking government official.
And someone truly helpful, but I mean, helpless, because Rachel Levine actually is in charge of sort of part of the military in a sense. So this is someone who is truly powerless.
Yeah, exactly. Totally powerless, totally defenseless. But that was what happened was we were put in a position where we had to basically censor ourselves and take that joke down in order to regain access to our account. And we said, no, we're not going to do that. And so, you know, Elon, was distraught by that. He wanted to make sure that comedy was going to be legal in the public square. And he was already very concerned about what was going on with Twitter and the censorship that he was seeing there. So he reached out to us. We had a conversation with him. And he mused on that call that he might need to buy Twitter. And so, you know, we were, we were wondering, you know, we didn't know if he was being serious or not, but he was making moves behind the scenes already to try to get that going. And so he did end up taking over Twitter and breaking us out of Twitter jail 8 months later without us having to delete anything. So that was, it was pretty remarkable what he did, taking a stand for free speech at great expense to himself.
Well, and you kept, you didn't back down, at great expense to yourself, because that's the way you drive revenue, eyeballs, attention, everything else. Yeah. And, you know, through the stand you took, that is what prompted him to act. And together, you all really saved free expression for a lot of us out here who have ideas that the powerful and the mighty often find annoying, offensive, inconvenient, intrusive, and unduly annoying. So we are grateful. We all owe you a debt of gratitude, you and Elon Musk together. And it really can't be overstated what you did by not backing down. So in the aftermath of that, how have things been? I mean, obviously, in the wonderful way that sometimes virtue is its own reward, not to use a hackneyed phrase that I'm sure some of us heard in Sunday school. I hope and I believe it led to even greater attention to the wonderful work you're doing and, you know, hopefully an expansion in your audience. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what your plans are in terms of expanding, if you have further plans to do more? And I know you are an entrepreneur and a venture capitalist. So, you know, it's important for those of us on the right to be mindful of the culture, because that's where so many decisions are made. I mean, we're a policy organization, but we don't capture people's imaginations the way the culture does.
Right.
Are you thinking about how you all can sort of hold the portion of the beach you've taken and expand further?
Yes. And we have grown. To answer the first part of your question, we've seen, this is one of the really cool things about the censorship stuff. It's funny to even start a phrase that way, but there are upsides to the efforts to censor. Is, they're shooting themselves in the foot, because often what they're doing is they are drawing more attention to the ideas and the people that they're trying to silence. And, you know, there's this thing called the Streisand effect.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. And not everyone's familiar with why it's called that. And we could get into that, but it's its own story. But the Streisand effect is basically when you're trying to suppress something, you amplify it, and it's an unintended consequence. Right. And I think that's happened with us. It's actually happened with a lot of comedians who, you know, the left has tried to cancel. There are people like Joe Rogan. They've tried to cancel. His platform's only gotten bigger. Our platform, we had about 1.4 or 1.5 million followers on Twitter when we first got suspended for telling that joke. And we have 3.6 million now. So, I mean, we've added 2 million plus followers. That's more than double what we had since we were suspended for 8 months for a joke that they didn't like. So our audience has grown pretty dramatically, and not just on Twitter/X, but on other platforms too. So, you know, we've seen a lot of success as a result of the effort. That's part of what's fueled our growth, is their effort to suppress our voice. So I tell that, you know, to encourage people that oftentimes it feels like, you know, you're losing. But you're not necessarily losing. And if you're willing to take a stand, you can come out on the other side of it. And they do oftentimes advance you and push you forward, even as they're trying to stop you. And so that's been our experience. And we're grateful for others who have made that possible and paved the way for that. As far as, you know, gaining an even greater foothold, you know, the culture, you mentioned the culture, it's the differences between policy and culture. You know, I'm a firm believer in the idea that politics and policy are downstream of culture.
Yep, I do too.
And there's some ways in which that's reciprocal, but the generally speaking, I think that when people's minds and hearts are in a certain place, you know, that's mm-hmm. where that's that's how you can affect change at the policy and political level and get legislation advanced, is by having an impact on what people actually think and believe about what's real and what's true and what's good and what's beautiful. And stories can have a tremendous impact on that. You know, books like Uncle Tom's Cabin had a huge influence on the slavery conversation. There's a great quote from C.S. Lewis, which is a bit of a paraphrase, but he said, "We don't need more Christian books. We need more good books written by Christians."
Yes.
And this is that idea that we need great stories. We need great, authors and storytellers and cultural forces at work that include strong values that will trickle down into the rest of society and then can, you know, see it in the soil of the culture, can then yield fruit that will be, you know, that will translate into policy and political change. And so the battle for the culture is a very important one. I think we're engaged in it in a very important way. Humor, again, is a very effective means of truth delivery, and satire ridicules bad ideas. And so, you know, we're doing that and we're trying to find new ways to do it in new formats, you know, branching out into other forms of entertainment. And so we want to be producing good books as Christians.
Yes. And finally, as we wind up, you know, I've noticed that it is the people on the comedy side of the ledger, people like even Bill Maher, Dave Chappelle, Jerry Seinfeld, who clearly neither of us would consider particularly conservative, who are the most keenly aware of the dangers of losing free speech. It's really amazing. As we began, we were talking about prophecies. As we wind up, is there a Babylon Bee prophecy that surprised you the most when it actually came to pass, Seth?
That surprised me the most. Well, yeah. I'll tell you my favorite one, because it's just so fun. It checked all these boxes for all these different things that make our articles outrageous and interesting. But we told a joke about how Trump had claimed to have done more for Christianity than Jesus himself.
Right.
And that was back in 2019, before he ever said anything like that. You know, it was just a joke about his ego and the outlandish things that he says. I think it's a good Trump joke. And it went viral because a lot of people believed it was true. And so that was funny.
Yes.
And then it got fact-checked and rated false because it had gone viral. And sometimes, you know, when that happens, I think that's even funnier than the joke itself. But then in 2021, Trump went on a radio show and said that he had done more for Christianity and religion in general than any other person in history. And so he actually said what the joke had attributed to him 2 years prior. And so that was kind of one of those ones where it was like, it was a great joke. It went viral. It got fact-checked and then it came true. And in fact, he even took it a step further and said he'd done more for religion in general, not just Christianity, than any other person in history, any other religious figure or politician or whatever. So, that just goes to show you, though, that the joke, there was some truth to that joke. We were kind of in tune with who Trump is and the kinds of things he says. And so there was truth to that. And that's why it was funny. And then, of course, he goes along and says it. So I never could have expected that he would have said something like that in real life. But, you know, here we are.
Yes, right. Here we are. And you can find the Babylon Bee at BabylonBee.com. One of my favorite of the headlines today is airport TSA workers move to border to slow illegal immigration. That, you know, there, it's funny because there's a lot of truth to it. You want lines to get into this country, you send those TSA people down
exactly.
There. It's going to work.
Slow them down.
Slow them down.
Make them take their shoes off.
And everything out of the backpack.
Yeah.
We are so delighted, Seth. We are looking forward to seeing you at our Yankee Institute Gala on April the 27th in Darien. Anyone who is interested in joining Seth and Yankee Institute, where we will be celebrating Seth and everything he has done for free speech, celebrating you as a champion of freedom, and celebrating Yankee Institute's 40th birthday. Tickets are available online, yankeeinstitute.org/events. reach out to any of us at Yankee Institute, yankeeinstitute.org. And you can, again, BabylonBee.com, at BabylonBee on X. And Seth, thank you. Thank you for all you've done for our First Amendment rights. And thank you for joining us for this 100th edition of YCT Matters.
Thank you.
And thanks to you all for having been with us for 100 of these. As always, this is Carol Platt-Lebow, president of Yankee Institute, and we look forward to having you with us on the 101st edition of YCT Matters. I'll show you around.